Look, Ma, two hands.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning. Happy Friday from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is one of those mornings when you can look at the first couple of sentences in a story and really not know what to think. On the one hand, the Labor Department says job cuts in May fell to the lowest level since September, 345,000. That is big news, shocking, since analysts were expecting more than 500,000. On the other hand, that same report says the unemployment rate rose to 9.4%. We're going to find out what investors are thinking when we check the numbers in just a moment. But first, let's try and make sense of all this by checking in with Bill Stone. He's the chief investment strategist at PNC Wealth Management, joining us this morning right now from Philly. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So what should I be thinking right now about the American job market? Am I happy or am I still sad?
Well, I think you're getting happier. How about that? I think, you know, anyone who's happy for more signs of economic stabilization and hopefully a coming recovery in the labor market has definitely got to be cheered a little bit by these numbers.
So what sectors do you think actually have for higher signs right now? Where are they?
Well, primarily education and healthcare. That's been a sector that's held up relatively well during this downturn. Some surprising areas that have been consistently showing more job losses and finally showed a little bit of gains were leisure and hospitality and food services. So you're seeing, you know, some of that, maybe people getting out there and spending a little bit of money coming back a little bit.
Maybe a little travel, too. Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we can't ignore that 9.4% unemployment rate, up from 8.9% in April. So the fact that it continues to climb, I mean, what does that say about how people are approaching the job search at this point?
Two things. One is, well, we still have to say jobs are, you know, we're continuing to lose jobs. But the second part is more people are out there looking for jobs. So that's why you saw that combo get the unemployment rate go even higher.
All right. Bill Stone joining us from Philadelphia this morning. Bill, thanks.
Thanks.
We do appreciate it. One more question this morning. Where's Wall Street? Markets are up at this hour. As a matter of fact, the Dow right now up about 0.4%, 34 points at 87.85. The NASDAQ up about 2 points or 0.1%, pretty much flat for the NASDAQ. S&P 500 the same, about 0.1%. We have Asian shares closing mostly higher today. They closed about 1% up. And in Europe, shares zoomed like a rocket after the U.S. jobs report came out. Stocks are higher there right now about 2%. A New York appeals court will hear arguments this afternoon about whether Chrysler can sell its strongest assets to a group led by Fiat. The plan is being challenged by three Indiana pension funds Chrysler owes money to. More now from Tamara Keith.
The pension funds hold $42 million in secured loans to Chrysler, and they want their money back. Instead, they're set to get 29 cents on the dollar. They say this isn't fair because secured creditors are supposed to be paid back first. And they say the United Auto Workers Union is getting a better deal. But bankruptcy attorney Steve Jacobowski says the pensions could have a tough time making their argument because all of the other senior creditors have agreed to the plan.
They're, what, 0.1% of the total debt that's owed to the senior secured class.
The pension funds have argued that they'd be better off if Chrysler was liquidated. So Jacobowski says that's why they want to stop the Fiat sale.
The court is unlikely to try to unscramble the egg so much when so many parties have relied on it and have advanced good money on the basis of that, absent a stay.
If a stay of any length were to be granted, it could be problematic for Chrysler. Fiat can pull out of the sale if it isn't completed by June 15th. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Hey, a bit of breaking news this morning. We're hearing reports that General Motors has a tentative deal to sell its Saturn brand to former race car driver and dealership group owner Roger Penske. He would get Saturn's dealership network, which consistently has scored high in customer satisfaction surveys. GM is scheduled a news conference, a conference call this morning to discuss that sale. You're listening to The Morning Report for Friday, June 5th, 2009, at Marketplace.org. You know, the pace of job losses seems to be easing, but still there are lots of people who are unemployed. So who's it affecting, and what kind of background do they have? Here's Mitchell Hartman.
It's lousy to get laid off no matter where you stand on the economic pyramid. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at IHS Global Insight. He says this time those at the bottom in terms of skill set have plenty of company.
Typically, recessions hit less well-educated workers harder than people with higher degrees. This is a broad-based recession in the sense that it's hitting all workers.
Of people without a high school diploma, 15% are unemployed right now. The jobless rate among university graduates is just 4.5%. That sounds low, but it's more than double what it was last year, 1 million more professionals unemployed. Baravesh says that just shows how deep and broad the recession is.
Typically, companies value those skills that they have and are more reluctant to let them go than people who have lower skill levels.
Baravesh predicts unemployment won't peak until early next year at just above 10% overall. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
China is making some big acquisitions these days, but the most ambitious deal has just fallen apart. We're talking about a $20 billion check to a mining company that's now getting ripped up. From Shanghai, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Chinese metals company Chinalco was to put $19.5 billion in mining giant Rio Tinto, which is listed in Australia and the UK. Chinalco would have gotten a whopping 9% of the company in two board seats. Commodities consultant Michael Kamisarov.
They bit off more of the company than public opinion, including the shareholders, could digest.
Rio walked away today after complaints from shareholders it was giving away the store. And given commodity and stock prices are up, Rio is not as desperate anymore to make a deal. There was political opposition, too. An Australian TV ad connected Chinalco to the Tiananmen Square killings 20 years ago.
It is definitely a setback to Chinalco.
Su-ik Lim is with Fitch Ratings.
But this is not going to stop Chinese companies from continuing to seek out resources.
The industrial China has big needs for raw materials like minerals, wood, and oil and gas. Rio Tinto is moving on, too. It still needs $20 billion, so it's issuing new stock. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
President Obama this week announced a Great Lakes Czar. The czar will oversee what the administration hopes will be a multi-billion-dollar effort to clean up the world's largest source of freshwater. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports on what it'll take to improve the water quality of Lakes Superior, Michigan, Huron, Erie, and Ontario.
Years of toxic chemical spills, wetland destruction, and invasive species have taken a toll on the Great Lakes, so much so that restoring and protecting these waters would cost an estimated $20 billion. President Obama has proposed spending about $500 million next year on the cleanup. Jeff Skelding is with the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition. He says that means choosing projects that will yield the highest return.
The challenge is going to be to spend that money wisely and to be able to demonstrate real on-the-ground success. And if we can do that, I think that the chances of getting this kind of funding every year for the Great Lakes is a possibility.
Skelding says first on the list are projects with easily measurable results, things like fixing leaky sewage lines and cleaning up toxic sediments. That would create jobs in addition to improving water quality. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Remember how the government was going to help banks unload some of their risky loans? The plan is called the Public-Private Investment Program, and as you can tell from the name, it assumes that private banks need the public's help. But lately, the banks have been surprisingly able to raise their own money, so the FDIC has postponed the public-private sale of $1 billion of those loans. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the banks are hoping they can handle this all alone.
If the banks sold their bad loans now, they might only get pennies on the dollar. Bart Steinfeld heads the investment banking group at real estate firm Jones Lang LaSalle. He says all the money the banks have raised lately makes it easier for them to just keep the loans on their books.
To the extent that banks are able to hold on to these loans and work it out themselves, that is clearly their preference.
So the government put its plan to help them sell those loans on hold. Tim Ryan is president of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. He hopes the plan's not dead altogether.
We've just lived through a year of things happening that we did not see coming. So for me, it's very, very important that they continue doing it, which they said they're going to do, so that if we need it, we have the ability through the government to expand essentially the safety net.
Meanwhile, the Treasury is forging ahead with a plan to rid the banks of so-called legacy securities. An official says Treasury will announce the fund managers approved to run the program in the next week or two. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One reason newspapers are in such trouble these days is that you can so happily get your news in other places. It's fun to scan the web for stories. It's easy to check your stocks on your cell phone. But there's one part of newspapers that seems to go best with a cup of coffee and some crinkly newsprint, and that's the comics section. Reporter John Raby wanted to know what happens to comics if newspapers die.
Jeff Millett draws Fraz, a sweet, smart comic strip about an elementary school janitor, out of his home in Lansing, Michigan.
You dream right from the start that it could be a living. I was able to feel confident enough to go strictly full-time with Fraz after about a year of syndication.
Millett grew up reading standbys like Peanuts, and now he's making his living drawing a strip that runs in 150 U.S. newspapers. But these days, the Detroit News, which runs Fraz, only delivers 3 days a week, and other papers are shutting down or going online only.
Sometimes I worry that they are just so ingrained and associated with ink on newsprint that they're just not going to fit quite as well into wherever newspapers go next.
All comic strips are already online, but nobody's found a way yet to get the web to pay enough so that drawing a strip can stay a full-time job. Cartoonists are worried. At their annual convention last month, they held a seminar on the future of newspapers and comics, where Jim Borgman, who draws the strip Zits, heard from a lot of frazzled young artists.
Yeah, you may have a syndicated strip. You certainly need to keep a website up. You're probably blogging. Some of these guys have, like, stand-up acts. They're in bands that, you know, somehow cross-pollinate with their strip. One guy looked up at me today and says, you need a staff to do this.
Cartoonist Darren Bell has chronicled the death of newspapers in his strip, Canderville, and he actually has a tip jar on his website. He says the money coming in from the web, not just in tips, is only a quarter of his income as a cartoonist, but he's not worried about comics.
Comics have been around basically since the first caveman found the first cave wall.
One thing we're fairly sure cavemen didn't draw on cave walls is crossword puzzles. They debuted in newspapers in 1913. Will Shortz is NPR's puzzle master and editor of the New York Times crossword. He says puzzles will survive in books and online even if newspapers go away, and the economic impact on puzzle makers will be minimal.
Honestly, most people are making puzzles because they love it, they just love the process, and they're anxious to see their names in print. They're not doing it for the money.
Shortz pays his freelancers $200 for a daily puzzle and $1,000 for a Sunday puzzle. But since he publishes the work of more than 100 puzzle makers a year, nobody's making a real living at this except him. In Los Angeles, I'm John Raby for Marketplace.
Motown's record is skipping badly. The Motor City's hit some big potholes. Pick a cliche for describing all the woes of Detroit, but there is one engine that's revving, actually many engines, that take people to a lot of different places, and local leaders are wheels up on spreading the word. From Michigan Radio, Sarah Hewlett reports.
Detroit Metro Airport was already one of the busiest in the nation, but when Delta Airlines merged with Northwest earlier this year, it made Detroit the second largest hub for the world's largest airline.
So that really puts Detroit front and center for starring role in the future of air transportation.
That's airport spokesman Scott Wintner. This week, Delta added nonstop flights to Rome and Shanghai out of Detroit, and company officials say they see Detroit as the airline's gateway to Asia. The launch of two major international routes was buried under headlines about General Motors' bankruptcy filing. But Wintner says the destinations, especially to the coveted China market, are no small thing.
And a time when we have to place a declining amount of reliance on the auto industry as our sole economic asset here. The airport is ready and waiting, and really has been, though upstaged by the auto industry, really has been a strong economic asset.
Local leaders hope to make the airport the center of what they call an aerotropolis, basically a cluster of businesses surrounding the airport, everything from warehouses and shipping companies to entertainment venues and corporate headquarters. Robert Ficano is the top official in Wayne County, where Detroit and the airport are located. He acknowledges the aerotropolis is a bit of a foreign concept in the U.S.
But you go to Frankfurt, you go to Schiphol, you go to Beijing, you can see that they've been able to turn it into an economic engine. We have this opportunity here.
Ficano says Detroit is better positioned to become an aerotropolis than other places because its airport has lots of vacant land around it. It's got gleaming new terminals, and it's near the international border with Canada. Marketing to potential developers is expected to start soon, and backers of the concept hope it will help restart the Motor City's economic engine. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
So, have you connected Detroit, or maybe you're less hub and spoke? No long security lines here. You can keep your shoes on and check out our website, marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.